I'm Mike Lubega of the New York Daily News.
I'm Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe and ESPN.
And I'm Mitch Albom of the Detroit Free Press. And welcome to the Monday edition of the Sports Reporters Podcast. We do this every Monday and Friday. If it's your first time with us, glad to have you along. If you've been listening all along, welcome back. It is Monday after the Final Four is now set. And isn't it something that in a first two rounds that literally had everything. I mean, a 16 beating a 1 and a bobblehead doll for a nun, that the very last game of the prelims, so to speak, is the best game. Is a game between two blue blood teams, Kansas and Duke, slugging it out, going to overtime, finally to see Kansas prevail, the end of Grayson Allen's career, coming on two or three three-point shots that didn't fall. It had everything. I mean, this was my only regret in watching this, guys, was that this wasn't the last weekend of the tournament. You know, that this was just to get to the Final Four.
By the way, the official tally of bounces on the rim, that shot of his at the end of regulation that would have won it, is 5.
Wow.
5 touches on the rim. And I think after number 3, you were convinced it was going down. And it refused to go down.
Bobby, the performance of the tournament occurred yesterday. Yeah. Of everything that has happened, whatever the number of game is that gets us down to 4, okay? The performance of the tournament was Malik Newman. Okay, yeah. And it put me down as somebody who didn't know how good this in what is up to now, the game of his life. He scores all 13 points for Canada. He is not their best player. Devontae Graham is their best player. And this kid stepped up when the lights were the brightest yesterday and had a performance. Bob, we have been passionate about this tournament since we first became friends, okay? I can't remember the last time somebody scored all of his team's points in overtime.
No, not that many. No, 13, absolutely. 30th anniversary of Danny and the Miracles, by the way. And you don't think that won't be played up in Lawrence, Kansas. But you're right. The game, the two contrasting games, the first game was not a good demonstration of the product, the one I was witness to in Boston. The second game was a very, very nice demonstration of the product, showing how good college basketball can be. Duke's going to be left with a lot of regrets. Why they didn't get the ball into Marvin Bagley when they needed to, et cetera. The what if of the shot that I just mentioned of Allen. But in the end, when a guy plays as Newman does, and you know the right team won the game.
I've been waiting for a lot of guys that I hear a lot about to take over a game and look like a man amongst boys. I've waited for Bagley to do that. He did not look that way in the game yesterday. I didn't watch every single Duke game they played. I've done the same thing with Miles Bridges, who, you know, you're constantly hearing about. These are guys who are all going to, and the other guys who are going to be the top picks in the NBA draft. You keep hearing about how their talent level is so. I mean, they're 1, 2, 3 in the NBA draft. But I watch them play a college game, and I can't see them dominate the college game. Newman dominated. He looked like a man amongst boys. His shot was pure, true. He was always in the right spot. He drove. He controlled. He looked like he was playing with 10 years more experience than the rest of the guys out there. Now, you know, come Saturday, it could be a whole different story. But he was absolutely the difference. And I'll say this about Grayson Allen. I mean, Grayson Allen obviously has had a checkered career with Duke, and he's done some amazing things, and we are looking at a senior, and we all celebrate that. But he seemed determined, both at the end of regulation and at overtime, to say, okay, despite the fact that other guys are playing better in this game, it's going to be me that's going to win it for us. And I'm not sure that didn't cost them, because he wasn't playing a good game, and he wasn't hitting his shots, and he insisted at both the end of regulation and the end of overtime on being the guy who took all the shots instead of trying to get it in to Bagley or some of the other guys who were having more success.
Well, he's the senior, and the only senior. I'm not disagreeing with you. He did take it upon himself. He didn't get it done. As I said, he came oh so close to getting it done, but he didn't get it done. And they're going to regret for a long time that they didn't try to exploit Bagley a little more. I got to talk about Newman for a second. I must thank educating me this morning was Seth Greenberg, who pointed out that earlier in the season, I don't know if you guys knew this, I know I did not, that Newman had been benched for a while by Bill Self for the reason being that he didn't seem to know what a good shot was, and he said he was out there, but he just in body, but his mind was not connected to the body. Frank, you know, Mike, our great friend Frank Power, the late Frank Power, always
yes.
told us about the connection between the mind and the body yep. with a great player, and you need the both. And he didn't have the connection, but he's got it now. I don't know when the connection was finally completed, but it was certainly in evidence yesterday.
And, Mitch, I understand that a gifted big man doesn't always have to rely on his guards. Okay, but there is a quality to a big man like Marvin Bagley that is like, even if you're as great as Jerry Rice, Montana or Young has to throw you the ball, okay? And you can only do so much, especially the way they were doing it. So I understand there will be a lot of questions for Coach K, especially about his offensive plan. And, by the way, as an aside, Bob, isn't it a sign of the apocalypse that Duke went to his own defense this year? Okay, having said that, Grayson Allen in the last two games of his college career shot 7-for-28 from the field. Okay, he shot 3-for-13 and he shot 4-for-15 on Friday night. And you know, Mitch, our friend Paul Westphal always has said that it's a terrible tragedy in basketball to be hot and not know it. Meaning, if you're hot and you're not shooting the ball. Grayson Allen was not hot and kept
right.
putting it up. And if the amazing thing is, Bob's right, we would be talking about that shot as being one of the greatest and most dramatic Elite Eight shots ever if one of those bounces had taken it through the net.
By the way, with regard to the zone defense and Coach K, something just flashed into my mind at the time, many years ago, but when Adolph Rupp grudgingly decided he had to go to a zone with a particular Kentucky team. He would not call it a zone. He called it a defense with a shifting parabola. So Coach K decided to go to a defense with a shifting parabola.
Well, the thing that was statistically, you know, because you remember the last shots, but obviously they're playing a lot more than just the last shots. And Duke was such an incredible rebounding team this year. And they were getting 40% basically of their own shots back on offensive rebounds. And what's the tally at the end of the game? 47-32 rebounds, Kansas over Duke. And that's really your story there. I mean, that's your story, including offensive rebounds, 17-10.
Basically wanting to play with four guards. I mean, you know, basically they went at him with four guards.
And as Asabuke fouled out.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, the statistics are very fascinating in the game, no question. But the thing is, the feel, you know, step back from the stats, and we're all fans of the sport, and I think we understand it pretty well. Sometimes you just got to throw those stats out the window. The feel of this game was a championship caliber,
yes.
high-level,
yes.
exciting
high
game,
level.
Worthy of a regional final.
And Mitch,
it was
worthy of worthy of a semifinal or a final, Bob. It was a great game.
A final? Who wouldn't have signed up for that game with those two teams? Mitch, here's the thing, and you guys have heard me throughout this tournament talking about how bad these games in the 50s are. I understand that this is a phenomenon beyond anything. This particular tournament where people know the name of a nun better than they know the names of the Loyola players. I get all that, okay? But yesterday, Bob's right. That was an advertisement for the possibilities of this sport. This isn't the most physically gifted team that Mike Krzyzewski has ever had. This isn't the most gifted team that Bill Self has ever had. But these were coaches who did not have a stranglehold on their players and so locked into the system and running the clock. This was college basketball for me at its best yesterday.
Yeah, and
historically,
we're going to see.
I think if you check. There have been more good regional finals games of this nature than there have been games in the Final Four itself. Mm. And it's kind of like, think about the analogy of baseball. Since we've gone to multiple playoffs, there have been some fantastic NL and ALCSs followed by very anticlimactic World Series. I don't know what the dynamic is at work, but I think there's a connection.
I do find it interesting that with coaches who run, you know, these blue blood programs and obviously have proven themselves to be good coaches, there just seems to be almost a rhythm to them getting back to the Final Four. You look at Self, okay, they've had very good teams, but they haven't been there since, what, was it 12 or 13 or something about that. I think it's 2012. But they've been knocking. You know, they've been knocking. And then now they get in 12 that they were there. Michigan, Same thing. You know, three times to the Elite Eight over the course of the last 6 years. Last time they got in was 13. Now it's 18. They get in again. That's not an accident. You know, we do talk about how this sport is dominated by coaches, and it clearly is, and it's more a coach-oriented sport than a player because they don't stay long enough. But we do have to acknowledge the fact that the really good coaches seem to manage to overcome these droughts of not being there for X period of time. Usually within 5 or 6 years, they somehow get back again. And we've seen this happen. Now Villanova, on the other hand, seems to want to go every single year and is putting teams out there that can. And I still think they have to be considered the favorite in this tournament. As good as a game as we saw from Kansas and Duke, Villanova's the only team that's in there that's beating everybody by double digits to get there.
Villanova,
and they look very serious.
Hopefully they got the bad one out of their system. I mean, if you're a Villanova follower, you're walking away with that saying that, you know, that was our C-minus game and we still won. So at least offensively, defensively, no, that was a good game. But then where do you draw the line with the kind of shooting that we saw? That's always an interesting quandary. Mitch, you are the perfect person for me to address this question. The University of Michigan has just advanced to the Final Four yet again. They have won, and it's not an uncommon occurrence. And yet, I want to know, from the standpoint of all those years of living out there, how important is this to the people of Michigan as opposed to if they were playing for the national championship in football?
Oh, it's quite big. It's not the same as football. This is still a football state, but Michigan has sort of a love-like relationship with basketball. Because Michigan football is so big, it has been in the shadows. And you know, when Bo Schembechler was there, he would, and then he became the athletic director. He would almost poo-poo the basketball team, and that's why it was ironic when Bill Frieder in 1989, you know, the season finishes and he flies out to Arizona State and secretly takes a job, then comes back and says, that's okay, I'll coach Michigan in the tournament. And Bo Schembechler makes this speech like, no, you know, a Michigan man will coach Michigan. But I was there with him. And basically, he had no consideration that the basketball team was going to do anything. So he was, believe me, if he thought that they were like really going to win something, I'm not sure he would have so quickly gotten rid of the coach. But that was sort of his attitude towards basketball. You know, at no reason and for no price will we sacrifice my philosophy of football coaching. So we don't need a basketball coach here. This guy, what's his name? Steve? What's his name? Oh, Fisher. you just take him. Just take him. Go ahead and take him. And then what happens? They win six games. They win the championship. And he is forced, essentially, to hire Steve Fisher, which was not something that he was going to do. And then Fisher then, after they win the championship, has two bad years and is almost on his way out, recruits the Fab Five team, and they go to the finals 2 years in a row. So all of which is to say there's this sort of weird, like, you can't ignore the basketball program no matter how much football fans try. And Beilein is Michigan's kind of coach. He does things
right. I got one more question for Mitch Albom, the Detroit man, which is this. What would it be like in Ann Arbor, Michigan, if Michigan emerges as the NCAA champion in both major winter sports, which is not inconceivable? Folks, to those of you in Tucson and Albuquerque and Rome and Abu Dhabi, you may not know that the Michigan Wolverines are in the NCAA hockey championships and are very much alive.
Oh, my God. All of those places, people are calling their bookies right now. Okay, let's talk about Villanova.
I'm just letting them know.
Let's talk about Villanova for a second. Okay, and Mitch, I said this to you the other day. I'm going to say it again. Michigan needs to get a football coach as good as John Beilein. Okay. Mm-hmm. Villanova, what a nice basketball team they are. And you know, this is something else we talk about all the time. Give me guards. Give me guards at this time of year. You give me a great guard who can control the tempo of the game and who can make knock down shots and free throws, I'll take him over Marvin Bagley every time. And you saw how well conditioned Villanova is to play games like this. And when you get down to the last 5 minutes and it becomes a fouling game, okay, not the crying game, the fouling game, give me a whole bunch of Jalen Brunsons. What, you know, you see now that if I look back at that Wisconsin game last year, Bob, and say, wow, they might be going for three in a row if Wisconsin hadn't clipped them in the second round. This is a really nice college basketball team.
Oh, yeah, and not just him. The big guys making their free throws, too, Pascal and Spellman. And by the way, we have to give a few kudos to the potentially the best player ever to come out of the state of Delaware, Dante DiVincenzo, who made the two marquee plays of the game. That baseline drive and stuff that put the lead back to 11 when it looked like they were going to falter at that point, and then that rebound follow-up dunk at the point in time energized the team and the crowd in favor of Villanova.
He does not look like a guy who can jump that high. Okay,
he's an athlete. He's a true athlete. No, he fools you.
And my gosh.
People in the world knows now if they don't. But the crowd, by the way, I have to say this for
sounded
Boston
like
Mets,
it was the Palestra, Bob. It sounded Mike, like it was the Palestra.
The Garden, you know, I've struggled for 50 some years to pump people's interest up in college basketball in this town, and we're not a college basketball town. But when we get the tournament, and if people come in, that place is jumping. That was a great place to be for both nights. Great place. Villanova people, it was like a Palestra game last night. That there's no question. It was great atmosphere. And, it was something I just wish that people here could experience and more people to know what college basketball can be.
Let me ask you guys this. Do you feel that the right side of the bracket is really contained? Mm. All the teams that should have been in the Final Four in the finals, and they're kind of knocking each other off, and the left side is going to send an inferior product no matter what. I mean, you got number ones playing number ones.
No. First of all, Mitch, when I look at I don't know how you guys look at it, okay? When I look at the ones through the fours, usually the ones have established themselves during a regular season that becomes far less meaningful as we go, okay? So I Michigan's the three. They could have been a two. To me, this is as much of a Final Four as you could ever hope for, okay? You got three famous names, okay? You have three famous names, and you got Cinderella, which is a different kind of famous name. You've got Villanova, you've got two big old state schools, the kind that dominate this tournament, and then you've got a story in Loyola. And it's so much more than Sister Jean, who, by the way, did have the line of the tournament when somebody asked her what she gave up for Lent, and she said losing. That's pretty good for a 98-year-old person, okay? But the modern Final Four began, I'm not going to do a long tutorial, in 1979. There was the NCAA tournament before Magic and Larry, and then there's everything that has happened since, and it has grown and grown and grown. And basically, there have been about four stories like this in those 40 years. George Mason, Virginia Commonwealth, Butler twice, and now Loyola. And I will tell you this, considering how big this sport is now, there has never been a story better at this time of year than Loyola making it to San Antonio.
No, because they connect, the connecting of the past thing that, those of us who remember that game, and I remember just so vividly watching that Loyola-Cincinnati game in 63, Cincinnati with the 15-point lead. But the thing is, at that point, Cincinnati was going for a third straight championship, and Loyola, was not happy to be there, we thought. But, in fact, I just learned there's a bar in Chicago called 63, which somebody said they're going to have to change its name to 2018 if they win. But, the connection, they've got the connection to the past. This is a rekindling of something here. It's not just like George Mason was utterly out of nowhere. And Butler did have the Hinkle Fieldhouse connection, and VCU was not out of nowhere, but they were building. But anyway, the Loyola, this is great because it unites the past and the present.
Well, Loyola's a good team. So, it's not just a miracle team. They're a good, solid team, and they've got some really good players. They're well coached. They have needed miracles almost every round to move on. Starting against Miami in their opening game. I mean, that was a mid-court shot that beats Miami 64-62, right? And then Custer's shot to beat Tennessee, Marcus Towns' shot late to beat Nevada. So, and then they had one game where they just handled things. Michigan had its own moment. I mean, they were almost out of the tournament against Houston. Jordan Poole doesn't hit that shot, and they don't even make the second weekend. So we have to remember all that. But I do think, And I'll do a parting shot on this later because it ain't any fun to try to work up a game plan to beat God.
If you give
John Beilein this much time to study a Loyola team, this is a very flexible Michigan team, and this to me is why Michigan has gotten this far. They have not played the same game each time out. Their game against Florida State was a defensive game. I mean, it was ridiculous. Everybody, there were more blocked shots in the first half than you probably see in three games of college basketball. Whereas the game before, they were bombs away, in terms of three-pointers. They can beat you offensively, and that's always been kind of Beilein's game plan. It relies a lot on three-point shooting, but they can beat you defensively now. They're very, very good. I don't know how they got this good defensively. They were in fifth place in the Big Ten midway through the season, but they went on a roll, just like it's not an accident that they and Loyola have the longest winning streaks in the country, 14 games and 13 games. And clearly something turned around for both of these teams in the middle of the season. I do think if you give Beilein that much time, he's going to come up with something that's going to work against Loyola. And I think they're going to win that game.
Well, what I love about Loyola, Mitch, what's really fun about watching them is, and Bob, don't you agree with this? Don't they look like they were some coach's second choice to be recruited or somebody's third choice? They don't look like a bunch of diaper dandies. They just don't. They don't. But boy, they play a beautiful game of basketball. And Bob, you were saying, who even knew who coached the team
10 days ago? Coach. I didn't know anything about him. I found out he's a protege of Rick Majerus. I didn't know. I mean, nothing. He's the mystery guest coach. The other coaches in this tournament, if you're a basketball fan, you know very damn well. But you don't know who Porter Moser is. So this is his moment. I mean, it's a moment for Sister Jean. It's a moment for him. It's a moment for the school that was completely ignored during the season by not only the local media, but by its own fans. If my information is correct, they averaged about a half a house in a 5,000-seat arena. And this year, nobody was paying attention to them. And when they were
just like church, and then all of a sudden everybody gets religion. Like,
yeah, this is Easter Sunday now Christmas sort of.
Yeah, hey, it almost
way,
is Easter
Mitch,
Sunday.
Mitch, yeah. Mitch, do you know, by the way, there's a story today that they have been given permission to use Sister Jean's likeness.
I know. Like you said, her own talk show, it's coming.
It's coming.
Before we get to baseball, which also starts this week, it's what a confluence of things going on. Let me tell you about Freshly. They are the easiest and most convenient way to eat healthy no matter what life throws your way. So even if you get stuck at work late, you can still come home to a delicious dinner cooked by a chef. No more worrying about having to figure out what you have left in the fridge, and especially no mess to clean up afterwards, because Freshly chefs source the finest all-natural ingredients they can find and then work them in with nutritionists to ensure that their meals are as healthy as possible. Now, you can go with steak peppercorn, penne bolognese, baked penne marinara, grilled chicken risotto. I love that. Veggie baked penne, all kinds of combinations of food. Believe me, this is not your mom's Swanson's. This is a healthy way to eat quickly. And the best part of the number of meals that they offer you, you can customize your weekly meals from their constantly changing menu, 30 different chef-crafted options to pick from, no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. If Thursday night or Tuesday night's the night you're going to need it, you can order it that way. Let me tell you, there's nothing better than knowing that no matter what happens in your daily life, you got a chef-cooked dinner waiting. Check out this week's menu created by Freshly Chefs, and you can get $25 off your first order of 6 chef-cooked dinners plus free shipping by simply going to Freshly.com/sportsreporters. You'll feel very relieved to come home to a chef-cooked meal every night with Freshly. Freshly.com/sportsreporters for $25 off your first order. Michael?
You would come home, and you'd smell that food, Mitch, and you'd say, thank God, and thanks, Sister Jean. Okay, let's talk about the NFL because they're having their meetings this year, and there were two pressing concerns for them: one on the field and one off. How to determine what a catch is after apparently like a decade of not knowing what a damn catch is, and what to do about players kneeling during the national anthem. And I hope you all noticed that last week they got Eric Reid to take any of these phonies. Okay. He said he'll stop doing it. Why? Because he's a free agent and he's not going to get a job and unless he buckles under, and might not get a job if he buckles under. Okay. And all of this played out in a week where another unarmed black man got shot to death in Sacramento, California. Got shot to death in California. Demonstrations and protests about that stretched all the way to a Kings game, okay? And Vivek Ranadive, the owner of the Kings, took the microphone with his players on the court, and you know what he talked about? Peaceful protest, okay? Which is all that Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed were engaged in the first place, except in their sport, Mitch, they can't get a damn job right now.
Well, I have such mixed feelings about them going in and trying to determine a policy on this. Here are basically their options. This is what they're going
None
to
good, right? None good.
No. If there was a good one, they would have already chosen it. Option number one, issue a rule that says it is part of the job expectation that you stand for the anthem, no exceptions. We can fire you if you don't, which is not what their current agreement kind of says. It sort of suggests that they do. That's an option number one. Number two, just make a league-wide policy that no players are out on the field when the anthem is being played. That solves your problem, but it's like that old expression, you have not converted a man because you've silenced him. You know, it just means you're hiding players away in the locker room. Number three, do nothing and hope that this has somehow leveled out or passed or whatever it is, because Eric Reed is not the only guy who is thinking what Eric Reed is saying. All right, there are a lot of other guys who in the NFL who might have been thinking about kneeling that are now no longer thinking about it. Now, the reason that I am perplexed by all of this is that, like any good thinking American, I would hope, you're torn between your First Amendment rights, which are critical, and losing sight of what is being done for the sake of something else, which, let's be honest, is what's happened last year. This thing became about the military. It became about patriotism. It became about so many things that it was never originally intended to do. And that's because, Michael, there is a difference between protesting in the streets as they did in outside of Sacramento, when a protest is called for all willing participants to come out on the street outside and protesting during a nationally televised game during the national anthem when all eyes are on you to start a football game and using that moment to make a protest. There is a difference. And so I am not sure how I feel about what would be. I hate all three of those. Well, I don't hate the third option because I do like people being left to their own
But Mitch, devices. Mitch, let me ask you this. And I'll throw this to Bob too. Okay. Don't you now agree that this has nothing to do with principle and it has really, it has little to do with the rights of employees? This was bad for business. Okay. This was bad for business. And how much of this has been grandfathered in to the cockeyed narrative that with this protest, they were disrespecting the flag and the military and maybe mom and apple pie too? That is, you can't ignore that is a part of what this narrative has become.
Which is exactly why I said what I did, because it was hijacked and it became, Mitch, all about something else. Let me give Bob a chance to weigh in on
this. It's more than a part, Mike. I mean, I totally agree with you. It's about, that's what it's became without any question. And it's all about the business. I know, for one, if we were having this conversation a year ago, which is a year, you know, well after the initial act of Colin Kaepernick, I would have said, well, you know, it's not really affecting business. I totally underestimated the effect that the amount of people that would react to this in the way that they have, and it's actually is affecting business. Of course, it's about that now for those owners, and it was hijacked. Frustrating, maybe predictable. I don't know.
We all remember the line from North Dallas 40, you know, every time they call it a business, you know, I call it a game. Every time I call it a game, they call it a business. Yeah. Okay, it's similar to this, except it's more than even that. It's every time we want to talk about race, you talk about the military. Every time we talk about the military, you talk about race. This is why I'm so frustrated by this. I don't think it accomplished anywhere near what people think it accomplished. And I think it got diffused into just anger. Now, when there's a protest in the streets in Sacramento over the shooting of an unarmed black man in that community, it is very clear that that protest is about that. What happened with the NFL is you had players taking knees. By the time it got so diffused, you didn't know what they were taking a knee for. You didn't know if it was about race, if it was about military, if it was about the NFL, if it was about you can't tell me what to do. So people ended up getting angry over all kinds of reasons that may not have even been connected to what they were doing.
We're kind of burying a little bit of the lead in that. Let's remember that we might not be having this conversation at all if the President of the United States had not interjected himself as
absolutely
in the matter he did, when he did, when this thing was dying down and may very well have expired.
And let's be honest. You cannot say that a lot of people were taking a knee because of their dislike of the current president and his philosophy. That's a lot of what's said and not being said too. I'm not saying, Mike and Bob, that this shouldn't continue. Sometimes democracy is uncomfortable and First Amendment is uncomfortable and I need to be uncomfortable with it. People need to be uncomfortable with it. That may be the best way going forward. I'm just saying that they now have three options in front of them, the owners, that are no good. They're not perfect. Let's put it that way.
My friend Bill Goldman always talks about famous people and what and will not be in what he calls the first paragraph of their obituaries. Okay. Colin Kaepernick taking a knee will be in the first paragraph of his obituary. Not that he quarterbacked the 49ers to the Super Bowl and nearly did it twice in a row. It will be that, okay? And I don't think his message was diffuse, okay? And any biography that will ever be written or in his autobiography, it started out simply enough. He was protesting racial injustice in the United States. Now, you may say that that is too big an issue to be organized into the simple act of taking a knee, but that's how it started. And all I said at the start of this conversation is it started because of too many incidents in his mind, exactly like the one in Sacramento last week.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. That's how it started. But we're a long way from
the
start.
Sacramento, classic.
What?
The classic one in Sacramento, unarmed.
A cell phone. Just, yeah, a cell phone. Armed with a cell phone.
Yeah.
All right.
Bob, you have some baseball questions.
We asked on Thursday, baseball gets started, and a lot of interesting subplots. It's not a happy time in San Francisco where Madison Bumgarner was hit by a line drive, where we'll miss a substantial amount of time, and on top of which Jeff Samardzija will miss, so two-fifths of their rotation's out. Not good times in San Francisco. To me, the most interesting, not best, but interesting team in baseball as we start the season is the New York Yankees, who, having acquired Giancarlo Stanton, having done the things they've done, and now have a middle of a lineup that is rather formidable, although a little less so perhaps if Greg Bird, who is injured. But anyway, I don't know if you guys agree with me or not, but I mean, to me, this is compelling. Their story is compelling. Watching how this will play out with a rookie manager is going to be very interesting.
For the first time in a quarter of a century, Mitch Albom, both the Yankees and the Red Sox start the season with first-time managers. It's an extremely unusual event in the history of this particular rivalry. And, Bob, I went and looked this up the other day. You know how many first-time managers have won the World Series over the last 30 years? Two. Even more than 30 years. Tom Kelly in 87 and Bob Brenly in 2001. So even though they look loaded, this is a lot to ask from Aaron Boone and Alex Cora.
You know how many trivia questions, contests you could win simply by posing who was the manager of the Arizona Diamondbacks in 2001? Wow. I forgot about that, Michael. That's good.
I want to ask both of you guys something living in those two respective cities. Because I know the media. I've lived in both New York and Boston. And I know the sports media can be brutal in both of those places, particularly if you make a mistake as the manager, and particularly in baseball, because they're both very good baseball media towns. You know, the fans are knowledgeable. The writers are knowledgeable.
Hey, you used to have one of those too, Mitch. You used to have one.
Yeah, long time ago. How much do you think the manager of those teams is critical to keep the ship? I'm not going to talk about the X's and O's, but just to keep the ship right when the media starts getting on them if you go on a five-game losing streak or things like that. You know, I always thought managing in New York in particular, the manager, the best managers were the ones who took the bullets and kept them away from the players and distracted, you know, and got everybody writing about them and kept the enormous New York media heat off of any particular player. How critical do you think the managers in each of your cities are for that, and who's up to the task of these two new guys?
Well, it's funny. Torrey took it all. Joe Torrey took it all for 12 years, okay? He was the front man. He was the manager. He's as great a top manager in the business of sports as I have ever seen in New York City, okay? And then it changed with Joe Girardi, who was prickly with the media, and Brian Cashman became more and more visible, and he kind of took more of it. The question you ask fits into a larger discussion of, you know, is the manager in baseball becoming less important as we go because of the obsession with analytics and how powerful these general managers are? I wrote a column last week about AJ Hinch, and in it I referenced the four stages of a character actor's career in Hollywood, once stated by Jack Elam. They are as follows: who's Jack Elam? Get me Jack Elam. Get me a Jack Elam type. And who's Jack Elam? Okay, and I made AJ laugh because he got fired after a season and a half when he was 36 years old by the Diamondbacks, okay? Because they saw the future template for a modern manager. Now, you know, like whatever it is, 8 years later, you know what everybody wants? They want an analytics guy who's good with the media, who's young and a great communicator. And Mitch, now the Red Sox and Yankees have hired a guy, so I think they're saying that they think Alex Cora and Aaron Boone will be able to articulate the team's message even in bad times.
There's one other factor that they need to every manager needs to contend with, and I think the younger you are, the better the chances that you can do that. And forget about the onerous media for a second. Social media. Social media is a factor in the psyche of athletes these days. And if you take a sport such as baseball with its 162 games day in, day out, no week to prepare, to settle down. And it's social media, absolutely. I think that when you hire now, the Boston Globe did a very, very good baseball section yesterday. And one of the stories they did was the proliferation of young managers and the theory behind it. It is very much
but
a
Bob,
totally
don't you agree?
World.
Don't you agree that and it happens fast in sports and in other businesses, they're all kind of looking for an AJ Hinch now.
Oh, this is the gist of the story, Mike. Yes, absolutely. And now we've got two 42, 43-year-old guys, one out of a broadcast booth, but the other off a bench from a world championship team. But they were very friendly. They know each other. They were teammates at one point. It's fascinating that they are winding up at the helm of these two teams at this particular point in time with the potential to have the rivalry back where it was a dozen years ago. It's fascinating. But the whole gist of this thing is that the old drill sergeant manager, those days.
Now, tell me this. It's 57 years since one team, the only time, a team had two players that hit 50 home runs in a season. Of course, they did it on the same team at the same time. And they were both Yankees, Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle. Now you have two guys who last year on two different teams hit 52 and 59 home runs. So now you got Judge and Stanton on the same team. What happens to these two together? How do they enhance? How do they take away from one another?
Well, I'm already scared, Mitch, that at the end of spring training, and this is analytics gone wild, and I am not anti-analytics. There's so much of, you know, what you know about the numbers that enhances your love of the game, okay? They batted Judge leadoff the other day, okay? And I know that they're going to bat him second sometimes, and I kind of was just hoping that, like, Ruth and Gehrig and Madeline Maris, they were going to hit 3 and 4. No. We can't do that anymore because we have to do this and we have to do that. I hope they don't get too cute by half with this batting order because the Yankees, I do not believe the Yankees are the team to beat. I believe the Houston Astros, who are like the Warriors to me of Major League Baseball, are the team to beat. but Ryan's been saying this for a while. The Yankees are unquestionably the team to watch, okay? Yeah. And because they have, this is Mantle Maris 2.0 or whatever they call it now these days. And the one question mark for me is, well, two question marks. One is, can Aaron Judge do it again? And two, how is Giancarlo Stanton going to respond in New York City? Because he says, I'm ready for it. Guess what? Nobody's ready for it till they're in it.
One other factor the Yankees have that makes it intriguing to me with regard to this lineup situation that Mike just alluded to is that there's a third guy who could, I think know for a fact, could easily hit 40, if not 50 himself. And, yes. And that is the catcher and Sanchez. And they, so you can mess around a little bit with your lineup, Mike, I would suggest. I think it's in that regard, you, and particularly leading off a guy who walks 135 times, if you've still got a cleanup hitter. You still got a another one. So, I mean, that's what makes them, to me, so interesting. And because I was throwing, I know you were poo-pooing it a little bit, Bird into the fat mix. Okay, let's eliminate Bird.
Hurt again. Hurt again.
He can't stay healthy to get on the damn field. So I understand.
I told you.
But they're going to bat most likely, this is a question, Judge and Stanton at second and third so that they get them up in the first inning?
No, I think second and fourth. I don't know. I actually don't know. And Mitch, this sounds like an odd thing to say, and it may sound counterintuitive, but and I'll ask this to both of you. Do you really want someone who is built like a defensive tight end running around the bases a lot, or do you just want them hitting home runs?
Yeah.
By the way, just so people understand what we're talking about with this team, the potential – the left fielder, the existing left fielder hit 20 home runs last year. The shortstop can hit 25 to 30. Am I wrong, Mike?
Oh, no. Didi Gregorius was hitting
one of the
cleanup,
underrated
Bob.
Player in the planet,
Bob.
Playing on the team he plays on at this particular point.
He was hitting cleanup by the end of the year, Didi Gregorius was.
I mean, this is what we're talking about for pitchers. I mean, that's why I can't. I mean, I'm fascinated by how this is going to play.
So I know they've got a great bullpen. I mean, that's clear. Like, right. You could cut their bullpen in half and they'd still have a great bullpen.
Right.
And by the way, could you do that and send that to Detroit? Because we'd like the other half.
No,
now that we've given
no,
away.
You're on your own. You put yourself in this situation, get out of it.
So is there, if they have an Achilles, is there Achilles their starting lineup?
You mean starting pitching.
Starting pitching.
They're asking a lot. They're hoping CC Sabathia on bad knees and weighing what he weighs and having reinvented himself as a finesse pitcher is going to do it again. We're going to see what Sonny Gray, who I like okay but don't love, is going to do with a full season in New York. Severino, they think, is ready to take his place with all those Scherzers and Verlanders and as an ace of the sport, okay? And then after that, Tanaka, you know, I keep waiting for his elbow to explode. He's got a partially torn ulnar ligament or whatever he's got going on. So if there's a weakness, but Mitch, they think that if they can just get four or five innings out of those guys and then let the bashers bash, that they're going to be fine.
That's no joke either, folks. He's not kidding about that. I mean, and they're not the only team that thinks that way now. The game is completely turned upside down in that regard. Your bullpen's more important than your starters.
Oh. Don't you feel, Bob, that pitching in baseball has now become the 4x100 Olympic relay? That your goal is just to hand off the baton to the other guy at a certain point in the game that is predetermined. You know, like get
unless
through
your
four.
Name is Kershaw and you have a 0.00 ERA in spring training, the answer is yes.
Yeah, it's
but
incredible.
Mitch, and again, I hate to bring up these guys, Scherzer and Verlander. I know that's a
stop. Daggers to our heart.
Mitch, I know it's a very painful subject in the Motor
Bring up
City.
David Price, why don't you?
But here's,
bring up Rick Porcello.
Here's what I'm saying. For all of the obsession about bullpens, okay, bullpens ultimately were a sidebar in one of the great World Series ever played. And I'll even include the last two games of the American League Championship Series for the Astros. What was the majesty of the game for the Houston Astros when they were up against it in Game 6 against the Yankees and facing a match point against them? They were able to give the ball to one of the great aces of his generation, Justin Verlander, and he stood out there, and he wasn't pitching four innings. He would have pitched 20 that night and basically said, here it is, boys, see if you can hit it. And then when did the World Series change? When did the World Series change? Because Clayton Kershaw couldn't hold a 4-0 lead in the fourth inning of game five when the stats were like 99-1 or whatever they were when he had that big a lead at that point in the game. All I'm saying is you still need aces in this sport. Mm-hmm. And the team that has the aces sometimes is the one that ends up winning it all.
Well, it brings us to the Boston Red Sox with, with a potential 1-2-3 as good as anybody's, if they were to even, I won't say max out, but go to 90% capacity with Sale, Price, and a guy who will go down in history as one of the more bizarre Cy Young winners ever, Mitch's old friend Rick Porcello.
Oh, I forgot him, Mitch. Did I forget to mention
Porcello? Oh, stop. Just stop with the torture. Before we go to parting shots, Michael, tell us about how to sleep in our lives.
Mitch, for all of the sleepless nights that you may encounter, during this baseball season. You see that? You see what I did there?
Very good.
Let me tell you about Mattress Firm, Mitch. Let's keep the ball rolling. The base for my argument is simple, even though you think I'm just being base. Your bed budget can go further when you're shopping at America's Neighborhood Mattress Store. It's a true home run, like the ones the Tigers pitchers are going to give up this year. They're the head coaches when it comes to mattress expertise, but know this, they are more than mattress experts. They have a game plan that helps you transform your mattress into a bed. From adjustable bases and sheets to headboards and bedroom decor, they have you literally and figuratively covered up like your favorite cornerback. Go to mattressfirm.com/podcast to see what deals are happening right now. They even offer you a 120-night sleep trial to ensure perfection and a 120-night low-price guarantee so that you know you paid the perfect price. Talk about a 1-2 punch. And Bob, think about it. If you could get like two of those mattresses, that would take Mitch through the entire upcoming Tiger season, right?
Through.
Problem solved.
And then he can, that'll turn right to football so he can get all excited about the Lions.
Yeah. I'll need another mattress, please.
Mitch, how much room do you have? Okay, so score big with a perfect bed. Head to mattressfirm.com/podcast to get the play-by-play on how you can monumentally improve your sleep today, tonight, and tomorrow. Time for our parting shots, and Bob Ryan leads off.
Now, you may like the three-point shot. I don't. I think it distorts the game at every level and is the single worst thing to happen to basketball in my lifetime. Did you know that the three was given to us by a showman strictly as a gimmick? It was Abe Saperstein, yes, the Globetrotters founder and impresario, who put it in his short-lived American Basketball League in 1961. It was picked up by the Eastern League and then the ABA, which also had a red, white, and blue ball as another gimmick, a showman's gimmick. Now, the analytics dictate that a three is better than a two, and so the entire basketball world is three-point crazy. And so we behold yesterday's Villanova Texas Tech Eastern Regional Final, in which the teams shot a nifty combined 9-for-44. I shall repeat, 9-for-44 on the sacred three.
That's not good. That's not good.
It was ugly. Now, not once in 40 minutes did someone receive the ball with his back to the basket in the low post. Nah, let's chuck another three and another. Well, you can have your stupid three. It was and is the legacy of a showman. The three is a showman's gimmick. 9-for-44. Analytics that.
Okay, let's regroup here for a second. The 76ers are good again. The 76ers are good and fun and talented and might make some noise in the upcoming NBA playoffs. The 76ers are Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons and who knows, might even win an NBA championship in a few years after years of the worst losing imaginable, the way the Astros won the World Series after years of, the worst losing imaginable. So what I want to know is this. After all the years when we joked about Sam Hinkie, the former general manager of the 76ers, who set this process in motion, telling 76ers fans and famously to trust the process. Was the process worth it for 76ers fans? When they were losing all those games over all those seasons and becoming even more of a joke team than the Astros once were, would these fans have signed up for the team they have right now? Everybody does a lot of hand-wringing, and properly so now, about tanking. The 76ers tanked their asses off It worked. It's like a baseball executive I know once telling me about the ultimate problem of what they were all going up against was steroids. The problem, the guy told me, is that they work.
It's hard enough for any college basketball team to beat any other college basketball team this year. But as a Michigan guy, I have to say, this isn't fair. The Wolverines now have to beat God. Okay, maybe not God, his or herself, but one of God's disciples, Sister Jean Dolores Schmidt, is 98 years of faith, rolled into the sweetest, most devoted, most holy basketball fan on earth. How is Michigan supposed to beat that? Why would they even try? It would have been one thing to knock out Loyola Chicago in the first or second round. That was expected. But now that the Ramblers will be one win from the championship game, I worry that anyone who stands in their way will be smote with lightning or afflicted with plagues. Imagine hitting a three-pointer against Loyola, then running down the court and seeing the disappointed look in a 98-year-old nun's eyes. Talk about guilt. Or you're about to shoot a free throw and there's Sister Jean giving you that remember what you learned in Sunday school look. You might drop the ball and run to confession. Without meaning to, Sister Jean has become the most powerful sixth man or sixth woman in this tournament. So the Wolverines better hope that she doesn't break out her Bible to the line that says, "For what shall it profit a man if he shall win the whole world but lose his soul?" Heck, they might not even come out for the opening tip. That's going to wrap up today's Sports Reporters podcast.
You think they should kneel during the anthem, Mitch? That's something to ponder between this podcast and the next.
That's going to wrap up this podcast. The next will be Friday, just in time to set up the Final Four. And, of course, baseball season will have started by then, so we'll have plenty to talk about. We do this every Monday and Friday. If you're new to the podcast, check it out regularly wherever you get your favorite podcasts. If you enjoyed it or even if you didn't, leave us a comment. We always enjoy reading those. And until we see you again, on behalf of Bob Ryan and Mike Lupica, this is Mitch Albom saying, have a terrific week.